Hey everyone, this is Jonah with Gray Area. Welcome to our series Spotlight, where our mission is to build a bigger and more united house music community by sharing new and exciting artists, festivals, and event brands with you. In this interview, you'll hear from Bontan, a UK legend known for melodic and acid house. Be sure to like this video and subscribe for more interviews like this. Just before we kind of dive into your career, I like to just ask a couple questions, just kind of background things. So for everyone who's watching that hasn't picked up yet already, we're here today with Gray Area, and I'm joined by Andy of Bontan. Great project. Looking forward to learning a lot more about it. The first question I have is just if you can tell us about a time earlier in your life where you feel like you kind of fell in love with dance music.
It's probably when I was like 18. I was DJing in a place called Southport. You've probably never heard of it, but there's a huge like a US house festival that happened there twice a year. It's like a soul weekender, but it was mainly DJs from America that would come and play. And I went 18, like straight out of college. I just walked into this room and everyone in there was way older than me, like 30. And it was just the best thing ever. And it was honestly incredible, changed my life. Because the first DJs I actually ever saw live were Kerry Chandler and then Masters at Work and then Dennis Frere. That was the three first DJs I ever seen. So it was just like, well, Masters at Work, Louis and Kenny, and then Kerry Chandler and Dennis Frere. I was just like, wow. I was blown away and I was like, this is exactly what I need to be doing. I need to be in this, figure out what's going on. And that music just sort of grabbed me straight away, man.
That's a masterclass for your first time. Yeah. It's funny, the Kerry Chandler thing. I feel like, man, I've been, you know, I don't know how many DJs I've interviewed now, but so many of you guys mention him, and Josh did too. And you know, he's so influential. You know, I'm curious.
The nicest person ever as well. He's so nice. I've only met him.
Oh my goodness.
I think once, but I've seen him DJ genuinely 15, 20 times because he'd come twice a year to Southport where I lived down the road from. And I was seeing him twice a year from the age of 18 up until when it finished not so long ago. And it was like, And then I finally met him when we DJed together in, I think it was Portsmouth. And I mentioned the Southport Weekender and he was just like, how do you know about the Southport Weekender? I was like, I've been watching you DJ since I was a kid, man. But he's so, so nice.
That's great, man. I actually don't think I've had the opportunity to see him somehow. He doesn't really play in New York too much, but hopefully one day. So was that your first show ever? Or do you have a memory of like the first time you played behind the decks, whether it was an official show or just for your friends?
The first time behind, I had decks when I was 15. My parents were stupid enough to buy me turntables. And I was just creating a racket, playing hip hop and anything I could get my hands on. From like anything that my friends were into at school, I'd then go to, it's HMV it was called. I don't think it's still open. I'd go and buy the vinyls there, play them at home and then play them for my friends. And then I started DJing. How did I actually get into the club? I think my first one, me and my friend, we started like learning to DJ properly. We started getting into house music, just like nothing mind-blowing, just anything, any popular house music around like the clubs and stuff around our local town. And then we had one gig, we got booked for one gig. Oh no, we entered a DJ competition when we were 17 and we shouldn't have even been in the club. That's right, I remember vividly. We entered this DJ competition and then the owner of the club came up to me and was like, how old are you? And I was like, 18. And he was just like and he's like, right, cool, as long as you're 18, it's good to go. And honestly, we smashed it. And then the guy that ran the competition my mate's won, and his mate won a residency, and then the club closed down like 3 weeks later. So that's probably because we didn't get the residency. But yeah, that DJ competition, I remember it because I was so nervous, man, and there was literally about seven people in the room. But fun, man. Good memories.
Yeah, things. I think you've progressed a little bit since then. I think
slightly.
So I'm just curious, obviously you mentioned, you know, buying vinyls back in the day. Do you remember kind of what kind of music you were listening to as a kid when you were coming up, or just what your parents were playing?
Well, I've actually still got all my old parents' vinyls. It's all a lot of Motown, a lot of soul and disco. like heaps of it, but like stacks of it. And I wasn't really into it. I remember hearing it around the house and being like, because whatever your parents are listening to isn't cool when you're a kid. And then I get older and then it's like, fuck, that was really cool. I should have listened. I was like, when I was in school, like from the age of 13, 14, 15, I was like listening to like hip hop and stuff, mainly American hip hop actually. And then I got into house music like from 16 onwards, just because you start going out and you start going to clubs. You're like, what is this? What am I listening to? It's different, you know? And then you dig a little bit deeper and you figure out, like I said, when I went to see Kerry Chandler and those guys, and that was when I was 18. And I was like, right, this is exactly what I need to do now.
That's great. If you had to choose between playing a festival, an intimate club, or a larger venue, what would be your choice there?
I do love playing festivals. There's nothing better than playing in the daytime. Just big, massive arena filled, and you're just playing just music that you love, and you can't even. I played at Parklife a couple of years back, and it was 20,000. Same for EDC Mexico, played there last year. 20,000 people in the arena. You can't see the back of the people. There's that many people there, and you're just like, and everyone is into what you're playing. And it's like, it does not get better than this, you know. Like, I'm just literally playing for myself, and then there's 20,000 people enjoying it as well. There's no better feeling. Although, and it is cool to play in a sweaty basement as well.
That's crazy.
Never take it away from that.
Those views from the stage are really something else. I just wanted to ask, you know, I think you kind of started playing Creamfields like pretty early on. What was that like for you, you know, having that hometown festival that's obviously like so iconic and being able to play it at an early stage in your career?
Well, I'd only toured for, I think it was a year and a half. And then I got booking for Creamfields, and it was to open the stage, the Pete Tong stage. And it was, you know, I expected a few hundred people to be there. And I was like, excited, this is going to be great. And then we got a call off the owner of the festival. And he said, your set times need to be moved, and you're on before Pete at 11 p.m. And this is like, I'd only ever played to like 250, 300 people before. I'd never played to more than that. And then this tent was completely packed, and there was 10,000 people in there. And honestly, it was the most scared I'd ever been. Because, well, for a start, my music was, I'd set me like track list out for stuff I'm going to be playing at 2 p.m. And then they're like, no, you're on before Pete now. I think it was Claude Van Stroke had to move. And I had to go into his set. And I was like, I had like an hour and a half on record on like record box to figure out what the hell I was going to play. But yeah, it was amazing. And honestly, the single-handedly most scared I've ever been in my life.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. Yeah, you got to switch out those like smooth daytime tracks for like peak time bangers, especially replacing someone like Claude, who has a very like unique, funky style.
I have a huge following as well. So yeah, people are like looking at me going, doesn't quite look like him. But it was fun, man. Honestly, I just sort of kind of winged it, but it paid off, because like I said, never played to more than 250 people at that time. So then to go to that, to 10,000, it was, and in your hometown as well. And because it got moved, it got streamed onto the Creamfields global website as well. And I think my Facebook went from like 800 likes to like the 15,000 in the space of one night. I thought I was a big deal.
That's crazy. I mean, I think sometimes it just takes, you know, obviously your career is going to happen regardless when you're putting out great music, but sometimes, you know, you just need to get a lucky break here and there.
Literally exactly down to luck. It wasn't simply just down to luck.
Yeah, absolutely. Something I am just curious about, you know, something I think we've seen in the last few years is a rise of sort of the branded party. And there's a lot of different brands, you know, doing really, really great events, whether it's labels or just, you know, companies that are only focused on parties. You know, you yourself have been associated often with Elro and Jamie Jones Paradise. I was just curious if you could kind of tell our viewers, you know, what those events are like from your perspective as an artist, and, you know, what the difference is between, you know, I think from the outside, they kind of have similar aesthetics, but obviously if you've been to them, you know that Elro is something totally different. So I'm just wondering if you could touch on that.
I mean, Elro it's like the most fun you'll ever have. Like, because it's simply, it boils, it, they it's just fun. And like, and I think a lot of people are like, take maybe the scene a bit too seriously. Like, if you comparing, you know, Paradise to Elro, they're both magical in their own way. Paradise is really music driven, and it, they focus like mainly on music, fresh music, and it's amazing. And you get to play so much like of your upcoming records, and you know, Jamie's like really nice, and it's cool, and like, the vibe is great. But then Elro is just, they go to full production, everything top to bottom. It's just a heap of fun, and the you know, they're in the same vein, but they're completely different, like you said, at the same time. So if you go to Elro, you're just going to just be laughing and messing around with your friends, and you've got hold of inflatables, and there's confetti cannons going off, and it's just completely bonkers, and it's so much fun. And you go to Paradise, and then you listen to the music, and you know, you go down that route, and you take it, you know, slightly more seriously. But both are magical in their own way.
Definitely. And I think it's just funny, you know, the Elro event here, which we'll touch on later, because you're playing it and we're very excited for that. But you know, for me, like, I've been to Elro in New York and in Ibiza, and so I have this experience, and I'm trying to tell my friends about it, and I was like, look, the lineup here is awesome, but it doesn't matter. Like, anyone could be playing this show and you just want to come. Like, I'm telling you, I promise, like, this is my job. Like, this is the best party.
Elro sells out without a lineup. Like, it just does, because Elro is just a beast by itself. And Elro Barcelona is honestly the best party I've ever played for in my life. I played on the terrace. I think it was before Richie Horton. And it was honestly incredible. That Elro Terrace in Barcelona, it's just next level, man.
No, and I think it's great too how anyone can play it. You know, Richie Horton is obviously someone that we associate with a more like minimal kind of dark vibe, but he'll go and play Elro. You know, someone like yourself will play Elro. The Fishers of the world want to play it. It's like everybody wants a piece.
Exactly.
You know, as we kind of take a look at your career, I think it was interesting because you kind of started out pretty hot. And I think often, and we'll get into this, you know, I know there's a lot of work that goes in years before you even put a record out. But once you started putting kind of official tracks out, it seems like it kicked off pretty fast. You had this early connection with Pleasurecraft. And I believe your first EP was with his label.
That's right. Yeah.
And then, you know, he obviously put that edit on your remix of Got a Feeling, which we'll get into later. But, you know, as I said, your career started out pretty fast. Can you just tell us about how you connected with Pleasurecraft and what that relationship was like?
I think I spoke to him on Twitter, and I was like, I've got some music. And he was like, cool, send it over. And I sent him it over, and he played it space on Space Terrace in Ibiza that night, and said, oh, I want to sign it. And within the 2 weeks of speaking to him on Twitter, him playing at Space, I'd sign the record to him. But simultaneously, the same sort of week, Josh had asked me to remix his track for him. And I sent Carvey over that edit, because that was pretty much, the edit was pretty much the first original remix. And Josh and, well, it wasn't Josh, the label actually turned down that version, funnily enough. And then Carvey said, well, I'll release it on my label. And I was like, cool. And then he put his name on it, and we got it out there. And that was like months after, because he was like, this is too good not to release. Because that version was actually the first version of the remix that MTA, which the original track of Josh's, was released on. And yeah, he just helped change the arrangement. We worked on the arrangement over Skype, and then we put that version out, and that just went bonkers.
Yeah, absolutely. No, so I mean, kind of following up on that, you know, that track obviously blew up. And when I spoke to Josh, you know, one of the things he said was it was almost like hard for him, because obviously he was really happy that, you know, his good friend was, you know, doing well on this track. But I think, you know, for him, it became like people thought that the way you remixed it was his sound, and he wanted to go in a different direction after that because his sound's a little different from yours. For you, you know, when you put a remix like that together and you're in the studio, like, do you know in your head, like, are you like, this one really goes hard? Or is it just you just think it's great because you think all your music's great?
That one just felt a bit different. And that only took four hours. I did that one in. And it's taken me like months to do records before. That one was 4 hours. And it just felt, I was like, there's something good in this. It was just so simple. There was like seven layers to the record. And it just fell together so quickly. And I was like, there's definitely something in this. So I worked on it a bit more with Carvey, and we sort of tweaked the arrangement slightly. And he was like, this is too good not to release. Like, it has to come out some way or somehow. So then MTA were like, cool, if you want to sublease it and, you know, do the second remix on your label, let's do it. Which was just mental how it just snowballed. But to answer your question, it did feel slightly different. There's been a few records that we've done. I Call You Back with Josh as well, when we made that. Because I was sat on that vocal for honestly 6 months. I didn't know what to do with it. I was like trying some ideas and it just wasn't fitting in. So then Josh was like, let's do another single. So I was like, cool. Went to his studio and I was like, mate, I've got this vocal and it, like, this could be big. I think it's just got that sort of gimmicky hook that people would sort of resonate to. And no one's going to forget that vocal after leaving the club. And that's all it boiled down to for me. I was like, people will hear this vocal, whether they like it or not. And I was like, boom, let's do this record. We did that in a day as well. And then we played it out at Sankey's in Manchester. And there was loads of social media footage going around, and then it just went viral. And then from that, the record came out and was just like be put number one for months and months.
It's crazy. I mean, when you have that feeling, it's just like, I'm sure, you know, seeing it perform live after you've been working on it for such a long time and had these ideas.
Yeah,
it's
crazy.
You know, one of the things, as I mentioned, obviously, you know, these careers don't happen overnight. So, you know, you put out that first EP in 2013. But as you mentioned, you know, you got your first decks in like when you were 16 or so, and, you know, you discovered house music like 2 years later. I'm wondering if you could just kind of touch on, you know, what that time was like for you before you put music out, and, you know, what the hard work was and the buildup was to kind of getting to that point where you felt comfortable sending music around and, you know, DJing before people knew who you were.
Well, I was actually DJing 5 times a week in my local town, maybe sometimes six times a week, just so I had enough money to not go to work in the day and I could make music. And I'd go to work because it was open till 6 a.m. every night in our town. So I was DJing six nights a week. So then I'd go to bed, I'd be up at 1 p.m. I'd make music for like the entire day. And then I'd go back to DJing in the nighttime again. And it was literally just, I'd play anywhere, anything, like for anything, just so I didn't have to go and do a 9-to-5, just so I could make music and teach myself how to make music. And it took years to, like say, be confident enough to send records. But I think a lot of DJs, well, a lot of producers that want to learn to produce music, they won't. I sort of bit the bullet and was playing these really crap gigs for like enough money to not go to work. I put my pride aside and I was like, I'm going to start an alias when I'm good enough, and no one's going to even know that I used to play these shitty bars and clubs around this town, because I'll have an alias, you know what I'm saying? And it's like a lot of DJs like, no, I'm only going to play the coolest music in the coolest club. And that's all I want to do. And if I have to go to work and it's going to take 20 years to achieve, or you might not even achieve it, where I was like, no, I'm going to DJ so I don't have to go to work ever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think also, you know, there's something to be said about doing that in the start of your career. And even if you never return to those spaces, you know, learning DJing is a skill as much as it is an art. And so you can, you know, be excellent with all the buttons and know how everything works and mix seamlessly. But obviously you have to read the crowd too. And, you know, having that ability to be able to understand what you need to play at a bar that, you know, no one cares that you're there playing versus, you know, a show where people are paying tickets to see you, I think it's important. You know, one of the things that I really love about your music is I think there's a common theme throughout it, but obviously your sound has progressed and developed over the years. In the beginning, kind of at least it sounded to me like almost through 2016, your sound was more, a little more like on the deep kind of hypnotic level, just listening to tracks like the Gadgets and Buttons, Always You EP, the Senses in 2016. Yeah. You know, when you were coming up and kind of getting started, who was influencing your sound? And when you're performing all these shows live, whether it was before you released or, you know, kind of immediately after you started, did you feel like your sound live was similar to the music you were putting out?
So I was releasing, you know, that sound, like I said, that hypnotic sound and that stuff earlier on. And then I felt like there was a heap of us doing it. And I felt like that I wasn't sort of, when I did, like, for example, Josh's remix and sort of that sound was, that was my sound for a few years. And like say hypnotic and deep. I didn't feel like I was trying to be anyone else. And then I got to like 2015, 2016, there was a bunch of people that, and we all were in this sort of bracket. We all sounded similar. So then when I did the EP on Hot Creations, I was like, right, I'm going to actively try and sound like no one else. I'm going to try and, because I've always been into like melodic, you know, house music. I was like, right, I'm going to do melodic house, but like club ready. So it's like, it's not too deep. So there's a lot of melodies, but it's still quite pumping. And I was like, I'm going to try and not sound like anyone. And it's, I feel like that's sort of what I got to a stage when in 2017, I feel like I've fully got my own sound now as well. And I don't try and, you know, be like anyone else. And that was sort of the switch for me, because I felt like those earlier records, it ended up being a lot of us all sounding fairly similar.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it, when I was listening through it, it felt like the first, you didn't go all the way there, but the first one that felt like you were kind of making that turn was, I think it was a remix of Mannequin and Heat at the end of 2016. And then, you did those two EPs with Jamie Jones. And then you collaborated with Yousef, who is obviously, you know, much more on like the tech house kind of sound. So, you know, that's interesting to hear that, you know, obviously you wanted to separate yourself. I'm curious, kind of akin to what I was saying earlier, were you finding that, you know, over the years as you, you know, you became a little bigger, you enjoyed playing out this different style? Or was it a combination of that and you were getting in the studio and you just were like, I need to change the sound?
Both, I'd say. So with touring, there's only so much like of those records earlier on. After 2 hours, it becomes monotonous because it's fairly similar bass patterns and fairly, and after 2 hours I was like, oh wow, I need to change this up, switch it up. And then I'll go back to the studio and try other stuff. So it was sort of a marriage between the two, where I was touring and then trying out new stuff that I wanted to sort of move into the direction of. It was working, and then I'd go home and make something along those lines and then try and make it my own and make it my own style. And then I started listening to other music as well. It wasn't necessarily what I was playing and making. I started listening to old acid house records and just doing a bit of history about old records and old music and the culture and stuff, and sort of moved away of more of a gimmicky sound and tried to make something a bit slightly more authentic.
Yeah, well, on that, you know, kind of in that vein of being authentic and going back to the roots, you know, you went on this tour. I don't remember, gosh, if it was in like 2016 or around then, but, you know, the Be True tour that you did with Josh Butler. And I just have to ask, obviously, you know, as I'm sure you could imagine, I asked him the same question when I interviewed him, but I was just wondering if you could, you know, tell us about your relationship with him, because you guys, as obviously you did the Got a Feeling remix early on, but I mean, you released music together as recently as like a couple months ago, I think. You know, you've went on tour, you still play together, you're playing together in New York. Just tell us about that relationship, how you guys met and what it's like working together.
Well, we met through a mutual friend. They went to uni together. So I think they were 18 and I was 20. I'm slightly older than Josh. And we sort of, my friend was like, oh, I've got this mate who like makes house music. I didn't think that's, I don't know what he's making at the time, but he's like, oh, he produces music anyway. So I was like, cool, met him. We got on really well and was like, let's start sending music to each other. And yeah, 11, 12 years later, we're still doing the same thing, phoning each other. Oh, I've made this record. And we speak every day still because he's currently in New Zealand. But yeah, I've not seen him in about a year. So it's going to, I think New York will be the first time I'm going to see him actually in about a year, year and a half, maybe. Wow. So yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun, but yeah, because our sounds, I'd say, are fairly different, but when we come together to play, we make it work. It's sort of a weird blend of my sort of like synthy melodic tribally sound and then Josh's house sound as well. And it just works every time it's just worked every time.
Yeah, I think I've seen both of you guys play separately, but never together. And you're back to back at Elrose again. One of these things that like I'm telling all my friends, like guys, like I promise they're gonna get the vibes here. I'm just wondering, when you play back to back with anyone, but in particular with Josh, what's the preparation like in terms of just getting ready for your set versus when it's just you.
Me and Josh, when we play back to back, we don't necessarily share what we're going to play with each other. So it's never planned. I don't think it would work if we did sit down and plan it. So the preparation's fairly similar. I'll get my records ready of what I'm going to play. I mean, I will sort of have in the back of my mind that I am playing a back to back with Josh and, try and not go too away from our sounds. But we don't necessarily send each other records, like I say, what we're going to play, because I think it's exciting when you see two DJs playing back to back and they're just going straight in. You can tell it's just like, right, we're going to see how this goes. And it's sort of a journey and it's not, it wouldn't be authentic if it was planned. And I think you'd know if we had sat down and planned it, because we'd be creating moments that we're trying to force upon the crowd and they'd stand out, Whereas yeah. I think if we just go in blind and we're just going to have some fun and just see where it goes, that's what's worked in the past anyway.
No, that's great. And I think it's interesting just because kind of the whole concept of back-to-back, it's another one of these nuances of the electronic music scene that only really exists in electronic music. There's really no other genre where like two rock bands are generally not going to get on stage for 3 hours together and perform a combination of their greatest hits. And there's obviously a science to it. And, I'm sure that you don't want to play back to back with everyone in the world, because some people, it just won't work. So I appreciate you kind of sharing that insight, because, even for me, I work in this industry, but I didn't really know, and I think everyone has a different process about it. You guys are obviously very comfortable. I'm just curious, how do you decide the first track? Do you before you go on, are you two in the green room and you're like, all right, let's do this? Or is it like rock, paper, scissors, Josh goes first?
It's literally, we'll go onto the decks and the person who finds, so we'll get our USB sticks, put our USBs in the CDJs and whoever finds the track quickest gets to play it first. So, and it all depends on what the person before us is playing. So depending who it is, if one of us knows a record that's going to fit the vibe, just to sort of get into it, then whoever's first gets it. It's literally a race. And then it's just usually one-on-one off.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah. No, I mean, it's really like you're playing back and forth.
The last time we did rock, paper, scissors was decide whose name goes first on a back-to-back. And that we did that when we did that 9 years ago. We rock, paper, scissors to see whose name was going first, and Josh won.
That's really,
it stayed
funny.
That way ever since.
Just briefly, you guys had this like really amazing opportunity when you were doing this, the Be True tour, to open up for Nile Rodgers and Chic, the UK leg, I think, of their tour. Could you just kind of tell us the little background on that and just how that came about and what it was like for you to share the stage with, such a legend who obviously is in a pretty different lane than you guys are musically?
Well, it turns out that's exactly what he wanted. He wanted house music. So my manager at the time sent me an email saying, I think he just said tour with Sheik and Niall. And I was just like, oh, what, are you getting his ticket? Have you got his tickets? Amazing. Like, let's go. And then he phoned me. He's like, no, Niall wants you on before him. He said he wants some sexy ass house music, quote. And then I was just like, what? Are you fucking serious? And he's like, no, it's honestly, seriously. He wants it for the whole UK leg. So I think it was 6 shows. But this is whilst we were doing the Be True tour as well. So we got the phone call and we were halfway through our tour. And it was like, this can't get any better. Oh, wait, you're on tour with Niall Rogers and Sheik. It was like, fuck. So we were playing like around the UK. And then the next day we'd have to go to Dublin to play with Niall. And then we were back home and played one show in the UK, then up to Scotland through the Glasgow part of the tour. And they are arenas as well. They are huge concert halls. And we just come from a 500 cap basement playing till 6 a.m. And then you're thrust onto this stage and you're like, wow, this is insane. And he is the nicest guy in the world. So, so cool. And yeah, we actually wrote some music with the bassist as well from the band. That never came out, but there was a period of time where we were sending ideas back and forwards and stuff. But yeah, that was just, it is what you think it is. It was completely insane. And there's a part of the show where Niall gets like 20 people from the crowd and gets them on stage each time. And sure enough, me and Josh were the first two there every single time at the front of this. The amount of selfies I've got from that tour is insane. But man, that tour, because we were, again, you just wanted house music. So we were like, we've seriously landed on our feet. We don't have to change the type of music we're playing. We're touring with Sheik and we're doing our own UK tour simultaneously as well. It was literally just completely mental.
That's crazy, man. I was looking through your Instagram and you were just you had all these pictures of him on stage. And it's just like, you know, when you're in the presence of somebody who has a career like that, I'm sure it's very inspiring. And obviously to, you know, have the opportunity to showcase your kind of diversity there.
He used to come out at the start of him. Well, whilst we were playing before the band came out. So when the venues had reached capacity, he'd come out and just sort of jam with us behind the decks for like 10 minutes and wow. Just like get into them just by himself before the show had even started. And everyone's like, he's there. Like he's just behind the deck with us, just like jamming to the music and like coming over, talking to us, saying like he loves, cause he said, I keep getting tweets off people saying the warm-up DJs are great. And I was like, that's what we do. And he was just super cool, man.
That's amazing. Wow. It feels like in the last couple of years, your music output has, you know, you've kind of sped it up. I think in 2017 to 2018, you know, you weren't releasing that much. I'm sure you were touring a lot at the time. But, you know, 2019 till now, you've put a lot of stuff out. And I think it's been kind of a wide range of, you know, unique and fun sounds, whether it was like 10 days on Crosstown Rebels had a little bit more of like an alternative feel to it. Shake It on Defected, obviously Defected, you know, proper tech house, and Sweat was pretty minimal. Columbo had a bit of that like Afro Latin sound to it that you alluded to earlier. I'm just curious, do you feel like kind of recently as your career has, you know, developed and you've found your place more and, you know, whatever, do you feel you're in a place where when you get into the studio, you're just making whatever you want, or, you know, kind of what's happening for you? Cause I do feel like you've been hitting a lot of genres recently.
Kind of. Yeah. It was just getting to a point where I was kind of getting bored with making the same sound for every track. And I feel like people will start to get bored of it also. I mean, obviously people like, you know, fans like a sound of an artist and they like him, you know, to be fairly similar. Everyone's got a distinct sound, but I just can't keep making the same stuff. So then I started like getting to more, you know, of a Latin sort of tribally feel. Columbo, 10 days, had, you know, a heap of shakers. It was still, you know, quite, you know, left, as you said, and Shake It as well. And it was just, yeah, I was just going in there making what I was sort of like listening to at the time and where the vibe was taking me. I don't necessarily, because when I play, it's never just one sort of vibe. It's always slightly different. And I feel like that's what I want my music to be. It's never just going to be the same every time, because who wants to listen to a, you know, a DJ playing this, you know, the exact same records over for 2 hours? I like to keep it fun, and that's what I want to do in the studio as well. Keep it different and keep it, you know, exciting every single time.
Yeah, absolutely. Could you tell us just about your recent collaboration with Book of Shade? You know, obviously another legend, and it's a really, again, like you went in another direction here. It's a very beautiful track, a lot of layers, a little more melodic. How'd you two connect, and was this collaboration a long time coming, or did it just kind of happen recently?
We wanted to make, when we made that record, we wanted to keep it something that people would listen to at home, because it was lockdown. So we wanted, when we made that, we were like, right, this is aimed at, you know, people listen to it on Spotify and stuff. It's not necessarily a club record, which is funny because in Australia, it's getting absolutely hammered in all the clubs now. It's open. And it's like, this is, didn't necessarily make it for this, but I'm glad it's happening. But yeah, we made that. I've been friends with them for a while. I played with them in Fabric in London about 3 years ago, when we sort of kept in touch and kept friends. And they emailed me and said, why don't we do a record together? And I was like, cool, I've got this synth line and this arp, let's go. And then they sent back a few more ideas, and I sent it back. We went back and forth for about a month, and then 2 months later it came out on their label, Blaufield. But I think it's a nice blend between our sounds. I've got my sort of acid line, melodic line in there, and then they built the chords out behind it and stuff. But yeah, like I say, we made it for not necessarily for club listening. It was to listen to at home, and the streaming numbers have gone, you know, through the roof, and that's sort of what we wanted to do with it.
No, it's great. And it's been interesting. I think one of the things I've tried to focus on, especially in the last couple months, is just, you know, how has music changed in the last year and a half plus whatever it is now, right? And I think what you just said is really interesting. A lot of artists maybe have felt like they need to make something different because, you know, are you going to make some, you know, hard four on the floor tech house track if nobody can dance to it? And so it feels like there's been a little bit of a rise in interest in that melodic sound, you know, which maybe translates a little more to like going for a walk or, you know, just sitting around the house doing work, whatever exactly. It is. As we're finishing up here, I just have a couple questions. Besides Josh, if you had the opportunity to go back to back with anybody, who would that be?
Probably Masters at Work, just because I love those guys. They're absolute legends. And if I had to listen to a back catalogue of any artist or, you know, duo, it's definitely them. Never missed a beat. They've nailed it every time.
That's awesome. I try and ask this question to pretty much everybody who seems like they play there. And unless I'm totally mistaken, it seems like have a bit of a history playing in Ibiza, you know, relatively regularly. I'm wondering if you could just kind of briefly touch on, you know, what it is about Ibiza that's so special, and, you know, why it kind of has this allure to it.
Everyone said this, you know, it's like kind of a cliche thing to say, or when you get off the plane, you can sort of sense it. But honestly, it's true. Like I say it as well. And I don't, everyone else says it, but I'm like, oh, it's cliche, but it's so true. When you get off the plane, it's just sort of this weird sort of energy. You know, before you go on a night out and before you go somewhere, you've got those butterflies. Like it's like pre sort of like event butterflies. It's like that all the time. But in the morning, evening and night, it's just, you've got this sort of weird buzz and energy. And then any club you play in, I've played in so many clubs all over Ibiza, and the energy you feel off people is just the same, no matter where you go. And I wish I could explain why, but if anyone listening is toying with the idea of going in the future, that's your number one place to go to in the world.
Oh yeah, I'm every year. I had the opportunity to go one time, and I was only there for about a day and a half. And it was not enough, but I totally like, you know, I got a sense of it. And every year I'm trying to get my friends. I'm like, guys, let's go this year. Come on, let's go.
You have to.
Yeah. It's funny because I think you, both Josh and I also spoke to Max Chapman recently, and they both said almost the exact same thing. And it's just, I think it just speaks to how it's so hard to describe, where they were essentially just like, I know this is cliche, but you just, you smell it in the air. And
yeah, definitely.
Maybe it's just when you get off the plane that, you know, there's posters for Jamie Jones and Black Coffee at the airport, and that, you know, that everyone getting off the plane with you is here for the same reason. You know, people are there to just have a great time. For you going forward, obviously, you know, this year having a slow start, but as we're kind of rebounding and having live shows again, two fronts, you know, from a music perspective, do you have plans releasing music more later on in this year? And then obviously playing the much anticipated, you know, L Road New York show. Do you have plans to tour the US at all besides that?
Yeah. So musically, I've got a single with Melee coming out next month on Defected. It's kind of like an acid, old disco-y acid record, so another direction for me again. But it's really cool. It's different, and that's going to be coming out in July. That's going to be sort of like the big single for the summer for us. And then, yeah, just touring hard. So New York, and then after New York, there's me and Josh are doing a few more back-to-back. So a couple in Texas, a couple in Florida. And then I'm back touring Europe, and then I'm back over for a couple of festivals in California in August, I think it is. And then I think I'm doing a few shows on the West Coast, and then yeah, Australia, if they let me in. and then just places are just starting to open back up again, like you say, and you know, opportunities are happening, and like my touring schedule up until 2022 already is just bonkers. So I'm pretty excited to get back on the road.
Oh man, I just have to say Melee is like another one of these guys, like up and comers, who has an amazing sound. I'm really hoping that you play that song at Elro, because
you know what? I'm gonna send it over to you so you can hear it.
Oh wow, thank you. I really appreciate that. That'd be amazing. I mean, when you just described it to me, I was like, I'm in. I'm all in. It sounds great. Well, listen, man, thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you,
this man. This was great. We're really looking forward to having you here in New York. We'll have to grab a drink at the show.
Definitely.
And cheers to you and Josh reuniting at last.
Yeah, man.
So all good stuff, man.
Cheers, brother.
Yeah, you have a good one.
Take care, man. See you there.
See ya.